Okay, so I'm going to talk about evolution of avian influenza viruses. I just want to make a disclaimer. I'm not an evolutionary biologist, I'm a statistician. I happen to wander into this topic sort of by accident. I'm going to end up with some conclusions and also some questions, and they're going to be questions for the people that know more about evolution than I do. I'm very sorry Philip Gerrish is not here. Phil and I have actually had some very interesting discussions about this in the past. So anyway, he sort of knows what my questions are, and so far he hasn't provided me with answers. So I wandered into this sort of as a back doorway of what I was really interested in is how do we find molecular changes that are essential for a change in phenotype. Now, Colin gave us an example of what I'm talking about yesterday, where he identified a molecular change that looks like it's essential for host adaptation of canine parvovirus. And it was a single molecular change that had something else going on around it. People have tried to find single molecular changes like that in influenza for a long time. It's sort of like the holy grail. What change is responsible for virulence in a virus? What change is responsible for host adaptation? And when people have been looking for these single sites, it's sort of the magic bullet, looking for a magic bullet. What I've found is that you find one subset of viruses for which that magic bullet holds, but you go into a different domain and that particular change no longer has the effect that you expect it would. And so gradually what's emerged is the understanding that these particular changes that are responsible for a change in phenotype are probably multigenic. There's probably at least changes within the same protein are possibly important, but also changes in other proteins may be important. So what that does is it says, right, you're confronted with a whole genome analysis. Now with influenza, if you want to do a whole genome analysis, you have to have a model of evolution. And it's been clear for a long time that, here comes Michael. I mean, people have known for a long time, of course, that influenza evolves by point mutation. There's been some, at least when I started this project, which was 2004, people readily agreed that reassortment between human influenza viruses and avian influenza viruses happened, because that generated some pandemics. But what wasn't clear, and this I feel kind of old because I feel like I've gone through the whole history of understanding reassortment. What wasn't clear at that time was to what extent reassortment played a role in a group of viruses from the same host class. And what I was interested in were avian viruses. And people didn't know what role reassortment had among avian viruses. And a couple of the sort of prevailing ideas in 2004 was that most of the avian viruses did not reassort. You got the occasional reassortment, it was an anomaly, but you could sort of imagine that the vast majority of viruses trundled along where there was no reassortment. So that was where I was starting from, and I wanted to first of all understand reassortment, because I knew that if I wanted to find these single changes in the virus that were going to be important for change of phenotype, I had to have a decent model of evolution. So that's where I'm going to start here, and you've seen this many times before. A segmented virus, I won't go into the details, but what I am going to emphasize is I'm not going to be looking at just hemagglutinin. I am going to be distinctly looking at all of the different segments. And just as I say, in 2004, most people's understanding of reassortment was based on what had happened in human pandemics, where you have a virus from a human, a virus from a bird, and they both infect a single host cell, and it was thought that the host cell was in a pig. Pigs sort of regarded as, well, it's possible that pig is a mixing vessel because it actually has receptors that will recognize viruses from both human and from avian sources. And so you have the two viruses going into a single host cell, disgorging their contents, mix and match, come out with a new virus. So what this looks like, and the sort of the basic method for understanding reassortment or recognizing reassortment in those days, and it still is probably the best method, is a phylogenetic analysis. And I have here, it's just a sample of human viruses and avian viruses, and I have two segments that happens to be two of the polymerases. And these viruses are all from around 1950s, 1960s, the time period really doesn't matter. Green is human, red is avian. If you look at the PB2 tree, you see two clumps of avian viruses, exactly the same viruses in the PB1 tree. But what you see is very clear evidence of reassortment. This clump of viruses actually translates to here. But this clump of viruses is split up into two places. So you can see both human and avian reassortment, because actually, interestingly, those viruses up there, they come from birds, but they have a PB1 that's just like a human PB1. These viruses down here are the same bird viruses as you have separated out in a clump of birds. This inconsistency of the phylogeny between segments that's used to recognize reassortment. Okay. What does it look like if you look at avian viruses? Remember, what I'm trying to get to is a model of evolution in avian viruses. So here I have two segments from a selection of avian viruses. The actual viruses are not relevant. But what you do need to know is it's exactly the same viruses in this tree as you have in this tree. If you're going to do reassortment analysis properly, you've got to have the same viruses in both trees. So easy thing to do is look at look at this clump of viruses and this block here. I've grouped them as a block. What I'm not showing here, bootstrap values, for those of you that work with phylogeny, you can actually get something called a bootstrap support for this branch, and it gives you some measure of the confidence that these viruses are grouped together. So these viruses here are separated into multiple groups, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think. So that's one piece of evidence for reassortment. This group is consistent. You have some singletons. This group here splits up. So not only do you see groups of viruses that are strongly grouped, a collection of viruses that are strongly grouped in one tree splitting amongst the other trees. But if you look at the trees, what you'll see is these blocks are sort of jumping around in their association with each other. So you get two things from this. You get evidence for reassortment, and then it really sort of brings up a chicken and egg question. Which are the ones that are maybe non-reassortants, and which are the ones that are reassortants? And that was the state of sort of the ideas about reassortment at the time in 2004 when I started looking at this. Remember, prevailing idea was most of the avian viruses don't reassort, some of them do. But if you look at this and you say, well, how do I pick out the ones that don't reassort and figure out which ones are reassorting, it's actually not really possible. It becomes very complex. Okay. So what we did was we designed something called the two-time test. Remember, my background is statistics, so I kind of morphed into being a bioinformatician at this point. And what we do is, in the two-time test, is we take the timeline of the virus that they're in, and we basically have sort of a sliding window. What we do is we say, up to a certain point in time, we're going to regard the viruses in that time period as potential donors, and the viruses in the subsequent time period as recipients. Because later viruses are either going to have the same genotype as earlier viruses, or later viruses will be a reassortant based on older viruses. I mean, it's just that newer viruses emerge from older viruses. So what we're doing here is splitting this up into two time periods. And what we're going to do, and I'll show you the analysis a little bit of what we do when we have these potential donors, and then we analyze the viruses in time two relative to the viruses in time one. And some of you that are used to working with recombination may recognize a sort of a similarity with an analysis for recombinants, where you have the parental strains that are non-recombinant, and those are your donors, and then you look for the breakpoint in the recombinants by comparing with the donors. But anyway, this is, at this point, not rocket science, but it gives you the spirit of what we're going to do. We're going to take these viruses, we do this in time, but first we do it for, and there's reasons for how we choose the time periods, but again, I don't think it really makes a difference to this analysis. And then once we've done the analysis for these viruses up to this time point, we move this time here, we slide this window along, and then our donors become an older set. And I think when I show you what I'm actually doing in the next couple of slides, you'll say, oh yeah, that's obvious. But what we have to do here is, we've got all these donor viruses, we've got them in trees like the tree that I showed you before, and to make the analysis manageable, what we need to do is get a single example of each distinct genotype here. Because what we're saying is, if we have all possible genotypes in an older time period, whatever comes along afterwards has to be related to what was there before. I mean, you don't just generate viruses out of thin air. So these newer viruses have to relate to these. They'll either have the same genotype or they'll have a genotype which is a mixture of what happens here. So here's a little sort of, the hard thing about this is actually coming up with these donor genotypes, the so-called reference viruses. And if we go back to the tree that I had before, these viruses were all in one block. If I compare the PB2 tree with the NP tree, these viruses split into multiple blocks. Now, if I'm going to ask, I've only got two segments here, but if I'm going to ask, based on these two, what would be my representative viruses, this one, and this one are going to be representative because they have an NP which is jumping out of this box. All these viruses have essentially the same PB2, but when you look at a different segment, they have different NPs. And so these three are clearly going to have a genotype which is one of the representative genotypes in the earlier time period. What we don't know about is these ones, and these ones, are they always going to cluster together? If they always cluster together, you only need one virus here and you only need one virus here. And to answer the question of whether they're always going to cluster together, you just have to look at the other segments. I see Thomas looking.
Yeah, I have a question. So, I mean, how do you know, so this box set on the left tree there,
yes.
Is it, and if I look at the NP tree,
yeah.
That box is split. How do you know that those sequences that are splitting that box weren't just not sampled?
Oh, they are. Exactly the same viruses in both trees. Every time when I show you two trees side by side, it's exactly the same set of viruses. Okay. This is one segment from every one of those viruses. This is the other segment.
Okay, I guess I was thinking of your different time points now. So if you go from one time to another, how do you...
Sorry.
It's just no sequences that you missed the first time that split.
Right. No. Let me just. What I'm focusing on right now is this time point, this time period, the first time period, the donor viruses, and I'm trying to find a single representative of every genotype that's circulating in this time period.
So these are H5N1s?
I have mixed. This analysis, we did all avian viruses in 2006, and then we progressed to H5N1. I will show you the H5N1s, but it's just, I have a couple of slides that are from the early analysis.
The H5N1, do we know, I mean, what's known about the founder effect for that virus? Because was that a, you know, was that a single introduction in the 90s at the whole time?
I'm actually going to get to, that's where I wanted to get to, is the analysis of the H5N1s. These ones...
The second set of data you showed, just the next slide,
yeah.
Is H5N1.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I'm trying to do at this point is just simply show you the analysis, and then I'll go on to the H5N1, and by that time you will have seen the analysis. So these asterisks mean that these viruses are actually got genotypes that are not replicated by anything else. So they would be part of my set of reference viruses. And as I say, if I look at the other segments, I would then determine if I need a single one representing these viruses or if I need multiple ones, if those viruses are split in another segment. So what I get to, with this particular data set, and it's not H5N1, but this was the first time I did the analysis. And remember, at that time, the question was, do most of these viruses not reassort and just a few reassort? People really didn't know. And what I've got here is I've only looked at four segments. It's actually for the replication complex. So we chose the replication complex because you expect that these proteins are going to work together. PB2, PB1, and PA is actually a heterotrimer, which is the replication mechanism, and NP forms the capsid. The interesting thing here is this tree is a consensus of these four. And these little numbers here, there's a 2 and a 3, what it says is these two viruses are sisters in 3 out of the 4 trees. These three viruses cluster together in 2 out of the 3 trees. The fact that you don't see 4s here and the fact that this tree looks wildly different than any of those trees is actually one of the first and strong indications that you have a lot of reassortment. If you had no reassortment, these trees would all look the same and they would all look the same as that tree. So that was sort of one of our first pieces of evidence of the amount of reassortment. And then we went and did the rest of the two-time test. And what I have here is a little cartoon of reference trees. Now, this is from the first time period. And this is a cartoon of an example of genotypes that are distinct from the reference time period for one segment, two segments, same viruses. So what you look at here is the brown and the purple are sisters in this tree, but the brown and the green are sisters in this tree. And that's the kind of thing that you would see. In fact, this is based on a real analysis. And now what we do is take these viruses here and ask, how do they relate to the genotypes here? If these viruses are not reassorting, they will have the same genotypes as you have here. And so I've just got two test viruses, and this is what we do, is we take the first segment from virus one and add it to this tree. If you have lots, it's just like an analysis with recombination. If you have lots of recombinants in your tree, you really have no good, they sort of shove the tree around because they have inconsistent evolutionary histories. So you can't get a good tree with lots of recombinants. You can't get a good tree with lots of resortants. So we take the reference tree, we add one virus at a time to the reference trees. And we do that for each one of the segments. And so virus one in this little cartoon is associating with the green virus for segment one, is associating with the purple virus for segment two. And so we actually color code that virus according to the donor virus for those segments. And then we do that for virus two and we color code it. So okay, here's your first real data set. And this was the first analysis we did. We did it for 4 segments. We didn't want to have to deal with 8 segments first run through the analysis. We did it for 4 segments. And again, it's the replication complex because we know they have to work together. And we thought, in some sense, that would give us the least chance of seeing reassortment because we know that they've got to be co-adapted well enough to work together. And there's actually another step in this, and I don't know if you can read it. It should be maximum passivity, not minimum passivity. But these viruses, these were our test viruses, which we've named here. And here's the little cartoon that tells you what the donor virus is like for each one of these segments. And if you look at these, and it was really something that was completely surprising to us, almost all these viruses are actually connected to another little cartoon by one or at most two changes in the color of the segment. So for example, this one is related to a virus that turns, well, you had to use as an ancestor by one change of a segment. You go down to here, there's another change of a segment between here and here. It turns out we actually couldn't tell you, oh no, that one I think is Duckwandong. This one to this one, there's a change of a segment here. And this was actually really interesting at this point because it was our first opportunity to look at the question of when these segments reassort, do they reassort in combination with other segments? Because people thought that the elements of the replication complex, because they need to work together, would probably reassort together, that they would be sort of cassettes of proteins that needed to reassort together. But in fact, what you see here is the mixture of colors, and when you go from one of these little guys to another little guy, they generally only differ in one of the segments, in the coloring of one of the segments. There's a couple of places where you'll see that they differ in two. This virus hangs out by itself because we can't associate it unequivocally with any of these others because it differs in more than two segments from any of the viruses up there. But we have this, it actually sort of tracks real time somewhat, but we don't claim that this is a necessary evolutionary sequence and just call it an evolutionary path.
Catherine,
yeah.
Typically, how much sequence difference would there be between things you color differently?
In this analysis, maybe 5%. When it gets to the H5N1, they're actually closer.
A follow-up on that is, if you also have mutations within each of the same
yes.
colors, right?
Yes.
So when you sort, maybe there are other mutations in one of the other genes
yes.
or segments that sort of make that association possible.
You can definitely have, I mean, we use a pretty conservative threshold for bootstrapping, so that I feel pretty comfortable. We're also using nucleotide trees rather than protein trees. I feel pretty comfortable in recognizing when there's a reassortment event, but yes, indeed, there are point mutations coming along. So the donor virus, we have a segment for the donor virus, and when by the time that donor virus has donated a segment to a time 2 virus, there have been point mutations, but you can tell the difference between point mutations and reassortment because of the silent changes. And I do have that in the H5 analysis.
If you built a tree for the second bar based on the point mutation,
yes.
would it agree on the left? Would that agree? Or on the right? Yeah, both on the left and the right.
Yeah.
That would agree with the picture here?
A phylogeny for the second segment.
Because that one's inherited. That's the one that's
yeah. It's actually. It's the same all the way down here, and it's the same color all the way down here. That's what you're referring to?
Right. So then you could build a tree for it based on just the point mutations in there. Would it look like this? I mean, you know, obviously you need to make actual phylogeny instead of this.
Yeah. But. Yeah. I don't know. That's an interesting question. So would you get the same segregation of viruses, same clustering and the same ordering along the backbone? Don't know. I haven't really looked at that. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Could you please go back to
yes.
So am I sort of misreading colors? So there is this Anyang duck that is different by two segments from its Austrian.
Yes. No, you're not misreading colors. That is a situation where.
Okay. But on the other hand, it is only different by one color relative to
yes.
one sea duck.
Right.
Is there a reason why they're hung that way?
Because if you're going to go from an ancestor to this, it's faster to go this way than it is to go this way. That's the maximum possible. I think there are a couple of places in here where you can get an equally parsimonious solution.
Well, I'm sorry, so this is then actually hanging on some other phylogenetic tree based on a single segment.
It's hanging on our notion of the ancestor.
So you also have a time ordering in there.
Yes, there is a time ordering. You see, these viruses were actually, what I've done, and I think it's part of the confusion here, I have mixed reference viruses and test viruses. I've mixed time 1 viruses and time 2. It turns out these were time 1 viruses. They're from 1996 and 1997. This is from 1995. They were both time.
Actually, now I noticed the timestamp there. So, indeed. So the time order is actually wrong for
No, you're allowed to have wrong time order. So it goes from 2002 to 2001 down at the bottom.
You can easily have that. It's a sampling.
You can sample it, so.
No, that's not what I'm thinking about. Anyway, I think I understand. So now, actually, an unrelated question. So to what extent, so how much do we know about so sampling here, right? So the question is, right, there are lots of viruses out there, and when we're trying to understand things in terms of recombinance like this, well, we're of course dependent on whether we've sampled this or that genotype.
Right.
Ancestor. So I guess the question is, so presumably if you start seeing you know, some of these genotypes repeatedly,
yes,
while not seeing other possibilities, that gives you some estimate of you know, how deeply your sentence of your coverage, right?
Yes, but it's confounded with the effect of how fit these are. And in this data set we pulled together in 2006, and there really was not a big database. This is exhaustive. This has everything from the database that was available that had four segments from the same viruses at that time point. So I think your question about the, you know, possible holes in the data set, bias in the data set. First of all, that's something that everyone has to wander into that works with flu. It's kind of the primordial swamp. But it's actually, I think if I get to the analysis on H5, first of all, these viruses have a mixture of serotypes. We also had some of that uncertainty. When we moved to a different data set, I spent many nights worrying about it, thinking, am I going to see the same thing? Or is this just a phenomenon in this data set? In fact, when we work with the H5, we do see the same thing. And I'll show you in a little more detail. That was what I needed to really know that this has some basis. So if I can.
Okay. Why is the one off by itself not allowed to go under the Shanghai and Shandong duck right above it?
Let's see. I need, in order to do something that I would regard as a reasonable connection, I need it to differ by no more than two from something in the tree.
It differs by one from the one directly above and to the left. Yeah.
Oh, here?
No. Above and to the right, that one, yeah.
Ah, all right. Can't tell you. Maybe I just erased an arrow that I shouldn't have done. I'm not sure. But yeah, it should connect. But you do, especially in a small data set like this, I think we did have a couple of viruses that we could not connect. On the other hand, we've only got four segments, and so everything is sort of not particularly robust. So just back to the original question of what is going on with avian viruses in terms of reassortment, this is just a cartoon of two sort of extreme models. The first model is showing that what I have now is actually two segments, a two-segmented virus that I've connected together. And these circles here are all brown. These are all blue. These are all red. So this is the model that would say evolution occurs more or less without significant impact due to reassortment. This is a reassortant virus. It's partly blue, partly red. This is partly brown, partly blue. This guy is going here, and the striation here represents mutation. So this is the model that suggests that reassortment doesn't have much of an impact and that the evolution is primarily by mutation. This model says that you have lots of reassortment going on. You effectively don't have any continuity of genotypes. And if you look at this previous picture, that's what it's telling you. Because this genotype here, it did persist until 2001, but there's no viruses from 2003 or 2004 with this genotype. And when we get to the bigger analysis, we see the same thing. We see that genotypes are lost fairly quickly, and that new genotypes come along and become the pervasive virus in the population, pointing to this model for evolution. And so these were, at this point, our conclusions that the segments actually reassort independently because the colors were not, you didn't get changes in that evolutionary path where particular pairs of segments were the same color. They were mixed colors. And so the segments appear to reassort relatively independently. There's no strong evidence of linkage between segments. New reassortants replace the earlier viruses, and the reassortants don't seem to last very long, and that was based on seeing a particular genotype with viruses from 1 or 2 years. We did ask how fast is reassortment. I have a maximum likelihood estimate of that, which I won't go into. I can describe it later. But effectively what we got out of it is if you have, you ask, what is the estimate of the number of years you create a new genotype by reassortment, you've got that genotype circulating in the population, what's the number of years until that new genotype loses a segment by reassortment? And that we got a median value for the number of years was 3. That's actually fairly conservative because the dating on the viruses is at that point was only by year, it was not by month or by day. And there was a 22% chance that a genotype would persist for longer than 7 years. So at that point, we actually went to avian H5 because this was about 2007. And avian H5, the flu virus, was obviously very important. And the other thing that was interesting was that there was evidence that in the early phases of the development of bird flu, there was actually quite a bit of reassortment, but people really didn't know exactly what was going on with the reassortment. And so this analysis, which is what I'm going to focus on, I'm not jumping around analyses now, this is your data set that you're going to be watching in front of TV for a while, is 651 viruses. The highly pathogenic H5N1 viruses are not highly pathogenic, but we only looked at the highly pathogenic viruses from Eurasia. So these are the bird flu viruses that came, first of all, into the human population in 1997, and they continue to infect humans now. We only looked at the 6 internal genes, which actually code for 8 proteins. The reason is the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase, which are the surface proteins, their evolution was actually clonal expansion. And not until recently have we seen reassortment among the HA and the NA. So there was really a single, essentially a single founder HA bringing along a founder NA. And so we didn't include the HA and the NA in this analysis, but we did look at the 6 internal genes, and I'm going to bring in the HA at the end. The time intervals that we looked at, you're going to use the 2-time test. So we have our time period for the donor viruses, time period for the test viruses. We broke up the time period of the test viruses, which went from 2000 to 2008, into 3 groups. And the reason is because essentially, by the end of 2001, we'd lost all of our representative genotypes in the previous years. So there was such high turnover that we had to break it up into multiple time periods.
Can we just go back to the previous slides? And so these turnover times by reassortment.
Yeah.
Was there any evidence that they differ between segments, or is this a, so you have an estimate here of a sort of exchange rate of a segment?
Yeah. When you say differ between segments, you mean some segments reassort faster than others?
Right. So then you think from the point of view of a single segment, so its diffusion rate.
Right.
What was the total number of sort of recombination events this was based on? What was this too small a data set to tell?
It wasn't a tiny data set. It was not a big data set. We treated all the segments the same, so this would be an average. And in fact, if you remember that previous picture, someone back here pointed out that the PB1 was not reassorting within those 2 sublineages. And I would guess that PB1, in fact, and when we get to H5, you see the same thing. PB1 really doesn't seem to be reassorting very much. So I would say, you know, this 3 is an average over the segments, but if you did it in a different way, did the analysis in a different way, you'd probably find the segments reassort at different rates.
Did you look at the distribution of, you said that there was a mean time of 3 years, and then there was some, did you look at the sort of the distribution of times that the segment spends in
No.
One genotype?
No.
Poisson process or something very different?
This is the model. What we do is we say, if you have four segments in your original genotype, what's the probability that in a time period between when that genotype was seen and when it reassorts, that, oh God. I actually don't think I can explain this really easily. You can see the binomial. These are the, what it's doing, it's going back to that. Do we really need to go into this detail?
Maybe not in detail, it's form here. So I was just like.
Yeah.
Just,
so I think maybe I'd like to get to the H5. It's not gonna answer your question. I can show you this. And then you can tell me. But I didn't go into a lot of the detail that you're interested in.
But isn't this sort of, why do you need a model at that point? So if you have these, you have phylogenies and you have recombination events mapped on
right.
these phylogenies, and you have time information, so in principle, you could sort of try to see how long, say, between two subsequent, or
right.
Two subsequent recombination events, or between two subsequent events affecting the same element, or something.
Yeah, but you sort of, I think you need, at least with a data set like this, it's not terribly big, I think you do need some statistics. Because, for example, here you have a 2002 virus, here you have a 2001 virus. That's,
I don't see how the time works in this whole thing. I mean, it's like you don't know that those viruses are related to each other in any direct way. When a virus in Japan and Korea and...
No, I mean, I'm not...
there's no evidence that those have any direct relationship to each other except through very distant...
They share a lineage, but it's not... I mean, if I had a bigger data set...
These could be separated hundreds of years for you, no, isn't that true?
No. No, this is the year when it was isolated.
Yeah, but they don't necessarily have a common ancestor that's like a year ago.
Well, let's see, where's the, pick two viruses, this one, virus here and this one, for example. So these viruses all have the same genotype. If you put these viruses into a phylogenetic tree for PB2, if you had a bunch of other viruses as well, and you measured the bootstrap support, that they would actually cluster in the same clade with high bootstrap support in the tree for PB2. So that's all you can do, is you can just say genetically they are very closely related.
Yeah, I mean, possibly, but I mean, Vietnam and Yokohama are several thousand miles apart, and I don't know, you know, is there a way to make the connection between those two viruses and a direct, you know, a recent common ancestor, I guess that's...
Well, they have the same genotype, so in a sense,
Catherine, aren't you saying that when you, I mean, you're also having short distances, it's not just high bootstrap support,
yeah,
but it's a very short distance between those two viruses, and therefore it must be recently, it can't be hundreds of years ago.
Well, that's the only way that I'll get high bootstrap support, because if I put
you can have high bootstrap support further down in your tree also.
Yeah, right.
But those are not the ones you're discussing. You're talking about the ones that tightly clustered
Right. These viruses, to begin with, are all relatively closely related. If you take avian viruses from 1993 to 1999, I mean, relative to the distance between avian viruses and human viruses, these are really quite closely related. So you already have some relationship, and yeah, these are tip, essentially, if you took a phylogenetic tree of PB2 and you worked up from the tips, you would find that these two viruses very quickly came into the same cluster in the PB2 tree. So, you're right, I'm not sure if...
Well, then maybe the H5N1 will be going to also add really to that, because I think, you know, there may be a more direct, you know, isn't there a more direct founding effect there where you've got the, in the outbreak?
Yeah.
So,
I'll show you this.
Yeah.
I guess I'm still a little bit worried about that the times on this differ so much. Like, you had like relatively wide time spans on the things that, that you grouped together. Now,
I think it
so one could try, but maybe this is what your method does, to make a phylogeny sort of based on point mutations.
Mm-hmm.
And that is usually, well, at least in the human influenza, maybe it's different here, is respecting time quite well. So
yeah, but if you
stuff that is similar in time at a similar point of the tree, and then one could a posteriori map these recombination events on that relatively time respecting tree,
right,
which is based on point mutations. But you're doing something related, but a bit different, right?
Yeah. It's, and I would argue that if you look carefully at a human PB2 tree, you will see a mixture of times within a year or two. And that's all we're seeing here, sometimes 3 years, but almost never 4 or 5. And that's in fact what that estimate of TR is telling you, is that you get a synth moving out and a new one coming in. It's telling you that things don't persist in a same sort of evolutionary cluster for longer than about 3 years. But I can show you, I'm sure, human trees where you get an intermingling like this. This is H5 now. We're going to do the same analysis with H5. And again, you can get an intermingling over the years within a year or two. It's not really, so if you take a particular genotype like this one, if there's multiple viruses, they could easily come from a couple of years, maybe 3 years, but almost never more than that. You had a question?
You said that you excluded HA and
NA.
NA. So these are on different segments?
Yes. There's 8 segments.
So say, it's a clonal expansion, so...
Oh, okay.
They are now linked, even though, so previously you said that one does not see linkage.
Okay, sorry. let me orient you to H5, because this is the data set we're looking at now. The segments, that early analysis, we looked at 4 internal segments. We didn't look at HA, we didn't look at NA, so we had no conclusion about HA or NA. So this analysis, we're going to look at 6 segments. Again, we're not looking at HA and NA, but the HA, especially if you look at the tree, it looks just like a tree from humans. It's quite clear that there was a founder for the HA, and it came from, normally people say, it's Goose Guangdong-like. There was a particular virus that if you look at all the H5s, especially from the early times, you'll see a clear evolution and a clear lineage among those viruses. The same is true for NA. There is possibly some linkage between HA and NA because they do have compensatory functions. HA is loosely, we've got someone that knows more about it than I do, but HA is loosely responsible for the affinity that the virus binds the host receptor. NA is responsible for releasing the virus from that host receptor when you get new viruses. So if the the activity of NA increases, then so it's more active, you can actually get an increase in the affinity, because if you have stronger binding and stronger ability to clip, they can go together. So HA and NA functionally can compensate for each other. So this is the analysis for H5, again, internal segments, 2-time test again. And what I want to do is just go through the 3 time periods and then get to the end and ask, you know, just sort of look at what we see from the 3 time periods. I can't put them all very easily on one picture, but this is the first time period. Goose Guangdong is here, and that's the one that was regarded as donating the hemagglutinin to all of these viruses. Goose Guangdong, interestingly, has, I've called it an allele B virus. There's actually one of the proteins, NS1, that exists in 2 very different alleles. And allele B is, there's two alleles of NS1 are called A and B. Allele B is never seen in humans. And this, in the whole database, 2 years ago, we scanned the whole database. It was only seen once in swine. So humans are exclusively allele A. And interestingly, when we do our analysis with the two time test, what we see is that between the ancestor, which we don't really know, and Goose Guangdong, which donated the hemagglutinin and is an allele B virus, there was a reassortment of NS1 donating an allele A NS1, which has continued down the lineage that actually leads to all of the viruses, almost all the viruses, that have continued to infect humans. This branch, allele B, you see some more allele B viruses which I haven't tracked, but they never really expanded the way these ones have. Why that reassortment event, we don't know. So in these early 2 years, what you see is these arrows are labeled by the segment that reassorts. Most branches have a label which just refers to one segment, and there's occasionally a branch with two. That could be that we're missing an intermediate, or it could be that two segments reassort at the same time in the same host cell. There's this other branch going out here, and in the next slide, what I'm going to do is show you what happens to this branch, and I'm going to show you what happens here. Now, these ones, I don't have the numbers here, but these little side branches, the fact that there's no arrows here, they didn't persist. So you might regard this as an unfit reassortant. It's hard to say. It's a relatively small data set in this first time period, but we didn't see any further reassortment on this backbone or this backbone. But this combination, this is actually, if you've looked at avian influenza, they talk about a genotype Z, and people did recognize that in this early phase there seemed to be quite a bit of reassortment, and it ultimately seemed to kind of lock in on a genotype, a combination of segments that then seemed to persist. And this was, we and another author point to this particular virus as being the earliest representative of that genotype Z. So you go to the next time period, and here's a recap of the previous time period. This continues to reassort. This genotype Z continues to reassort quite a lot, but this triangle here is actually representing that in this 2 year period, we found a huge number of viruses. You see these, I don't have the numbers, and the 19 and 20 just refers to the genotype, not the number of viruses. But there's not many viruses in here. This, on the other hand, is 120 viruses that don't differ from this virus by reassortment. On the other hand, this gets back to Thomas's point. It's a bit small to see here, but up here, PB2 is a solid red bar. Down here, PB2 is a dotted red bar. And that's to show that, in fact, you do see distinct point mutations that differentiate this segment from this segment. And so most of these down here are dotted. There's a solid here, which might be a mistake. I'm not quite sure. But so the dotted, it retains the color, meaning it's the same lineage, but the dot means that there's clearly point mutational differences. So the 120 viruses, I want to go down and show you what happens here, but this lineage, actually, that was it. After 2003. I think we saw one virus in 2004, but this is starting to get a substantially bigger data set now. We have 120 viruses here, and we have a whole bunch more there. There's probably 150 to 200 viruses here.
Do you know where the segments are coming from? Are they just randomly coming out of other avian flus, or
no? By the time, so back here, in the paper we do have the virus that's sort of the representative of the lineage that they come from. These reassortment events are mostly involving viruses with a different serotype. and H6N1, H9N2, H7 something or another. So most of the viruses you see when we have a new color coming in like this turquoise here, that virus came with, well, that lineage we represented by a particular virus, the closest that we could find in the database to that segment. And I don't know for sure about this one, but a lot of these had different serotypes. When you get down to here, these reassortment events are often from H5N1 viruses that have actually diverged enough so that you can tell that it's reassortment and not just point mutation. And this is the third time period. And you actually, there's more reassortment here. Some of that's H5N1 and some of it is not H5N1. What I haven't shown here, so let me just tell you what this is. This is the first time period that you just saw. This is the second time period. These viruses spit out a whole bunch of reassortants, but they didn't go any further. This is the group of 120 that looked just like this one. And I've got three arrows here bringing you up to here. And what we found, which was very interesting to us, was this genotype Z, which was sort of the one that people thought had kind of locked in as being very fit, has actually got split into three distinguishable, phylogenetically distinguishable sublineages, which we call Z.1, Z.2, and Z.3. So they're not distinguishable for every segment. For example, this segment here is actually the nuclear protein, and you'll see it's a solid orange bar in every one, so you can't distinguish those. But you actually can distinguish phylogenetically these clusters of PB2, PB1, PA, and NS here is the same between these two, but it differs from this. And this is actually now over a period from 2004 to 2008, and I have 175 viruses here. 2008, we wrote up the paper and I haven't actually genotyped any more since then. But what was interesting was there's 175 viruses over a four-year time period, all with a genotype that can't be distinguished from that by reassortment. Actually, I've oversimplified it. You can start to see some reassortment within here because, of course, these viruses are also mutating. And there's now in Africa, you can see that there's some sort of subclades in here, and you can actually start to see reassortment between those subclades. You do see viruses with this genotype that reassort with wildly different viruses, but we only see single representatives of those. So it's clear that there is some opportunity, I don't know how great, but there is some opportunity for these viruses to reassort. But essentially, this is 175 viruses, they're continuing to propagate in the absence of reassortment over substantial periods of time. The other thing that was interesting was when we looked at, I just wanted to point out, I've actually just copied the conclusions from the previous study, and this was very sort of reassuring, is that this study also shows segments reassorting relatively independently, because those colors are not, you don't see subsets of the segments that are all reassorting with the same color. We also see that older reassortant genotypes are being replaced by newer ones, and that reassortants circulate for an apparently short period of time. So if we go back to this, this is actually one of these sublineages which actually did continue to reassort, and this actually has continued to expand in 2010. It's one of the dominant sublineages now, and it's one to which people are trying to develop a vaccine. Yeah.
So these are still viruses that are sampled from birds?
Yes, these are all, I'm so sorry, I keep forgetting that I'm talking about one who lives and breathes avian H5N1. These are all highly pathogenic avian H5N1, and they come from Eurasia, so they all come from the same outbreak. We do not have viruses in here from North America, from South America. There are European viruses. There's no South Pacific viruses in here.
Pathogenic for chicken?
The highly pathogenic Vachickagius, that is effectively the definition of high pathogenicity, that they will kill a chicken, but they don't necessarily kill a duck or a gull or other birds. So there's a whole mixture of birds in here. There's wild birds, there's domestic birds, there's birds that you can't really tell because they're only labeled duck. There's 651 viruses in the whole study, and for those 651 viruses, we have the six segments, almost full-length gene segment, at least almost full-length for every one of those. Yeah.
I'm a little bit puzzled by the comparison of the two studies, because if I understand correctly, you're saying that they're illustrating the same dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas somehow looking at your pictures here, we see these gigantic sort of semi-clonal radiations,
right?
And which we certainly didn't see in the other one.
You're
so is it the matter of sampling, or
I don't know.
I'm seeing the same story.
Right. So I guess what you're seeing is my failure in presentation. So up to this point, we're seeing the same story. Genotypes like these ones, created, they don't last very long. When you see these arrows here, here's a new genotype, new genotypes. These ones didn't last. This one didn't last because it reassorted and so on. So ignoring this and this, we see essentially the same picture.
But
and,
can we ignore
it? Well, no. I mean, as I said at the beginning, I'm not...
We would sort of think that actually the evolution is driven by sort of outliers, you know, something with particular high fitness that's going to generate sort of a gigantic clone and is going to overtake everything else.
So...
Are we... in fact, getting a bit of this evolutionary jump in action here?
Well, I don't know. You see, I have this as on my conclusion slide. It's actually a question. I really don't know. Let me tell you a little more background, and then maybe you have the answer by the time I get to the last slide, which is, I think, about two or three down the line. These substitutions here, the distinction here, it turns out PB1, you do get phylogenetic distinctions. This is a solid line, this is a dotted line, this is a square line. You get phylogenetic distinctions, but actually, interestingly, we didn't see any amino acid differences. They were phylogenetically different, but it was all silent change. PB2 had some very interesting changes. It turns out this group of viruses has some very interesting changes that are basal to that group. We have looked at NS1. In fact, we've looked experimentally at NS1. There, again, are a couple of very odd amino acid changes that are basal to this group of viruses. We've actually tested them, and we have found that, in fact, they're very tightly co-evolved. That if you take either, and I won't tell you the details, but if you take either one of those changes, you get no function. If you take the two changes together, you get a very strong change in phenotype and also host cell tropism. The virus goes from being respiratory to intestinal. So one of the things that has been quite exciting is, and we didn't know this was going to happen, but by dealing with reassortment and by actually looking at the evolutionary picture in this way, we've managed to clarify some of the confusion that there's been in the field, where people have said, well, you know, there's viruses from Guangxi that look like genotype Z, and some that from Guangxi that look like genotype 12 and genotype V and all the rest of it. But if you look at it in this way, you can actually see that there's some very interesting relationships among the genotypes. So that was one of the things that we found. As I mentioned, no significant reassortment down here. And, so I couldn't see what was going on. The other thing that was interesting, and we now come back to hemagglutinin, which a lot of people focus on, is if you look at these viruses in this group, they exclusively have a clade 2.2 hemagglutinin. Hemagglutinin came in from this initial virus, Goose Guangdong. It evolved by point mutation, but as long as something evolves long enough, you're likely to see sublineages of that tree. And the sublineages of the tree are being characterized, the WHO has characterized them. They have also been studied antigenically, and some of these sublineages are non-cross-reactive antigenically. And I don't know the details of 2.2 versus 2.34 to know how not cross-reactive they are, but they are distinctly phylogenetically distinct. These viruses here are all 2.2, or now they've actually subdivided it into 2.2.1. These viruses are almost entirely 2.3.4. These ones are exclusively clade 1. Now, and those ones are 2.1 up there. These viruses are in Indonesia, and they are still currently circulating. Here's the contrast. These viruses, this is genotype Z, the one that was the first instance of what people thought was probably a really good, robust combination of segments. And in this backbone, with no change in genotype, you see all these quite distinct clades of HA, a lot of variety. So one, this HA1 is actually continuing here. 9, 5, 7, 5, 4, 3, and there may be a couple of others, but a huge amount of variation in the HA on this single background. Then, by contrast, whoops, it's missing. Oh, here, which is the same as this one. This one, lots of reassortment, but if you look at the HA from these viruses, they're almost identical. I don't have an answer. Okay, last slide. So, my first point here is just really coming back to this first question. How do we find amino acid changes that are really important for a change in the phenotype? It's quite clear to me that we have to have a rigorous way of dealing with reassortment. Just imagining that reassortment is a second order of effect, I don't think cuts it. Reassortment and point mutation both contribute significantly to evolution over a short period of time with these viruses. I haven't done the analysis for other viruses other than that very early analysis, but it's clear that they do contribute. Reassortment creates novel genotypes, many of which are unsuccessful. So we got all those branches that didn't continue. And I'll say unsuccessful, we don't know to what extent epidemiology determines the lack of success. They might have been, if you put them in a cell culture, very fit. They just happen to have bad luck out in the field. And then this last point, which this gentleman back here pointed to, is we get apparently stable lineages by point mutation, and that brings up the question, and this is what I was discussing with Phil Gerrish, was whether there's stasis. Can we see if there's covariation among the amino acid changes that are sort of the signatures for those lineages, that if we tested them like we did with the NS1, we would find that in fact they are linked. And I think that has to be determined experimentally. So I wish I could push this up, because this is really, as I said, I'm not an evolutionary biologist. I see this very interesting evolutionary pattern. I don't know how to sort of pose hypotheses that could perhaps be tested in a model or perhaps tested experimentally. I do think that from the viewpoint of the influenza virologists, it does raise a very interesting question about possibility of interaction between the surface proteins, the hemagglutinin, and the internal proteins, which we saw in the last picture, where we saw in certain genotypic backgrounds, the hemagglutinin could vary enormously, but in other genotypic backgrounds, the hemagglutinin didn't vary. It was really stable. So I don't have anything else to say. Questions? Back here, yes.
So is there another time point on the expansion of your stable lineage, so that there was 120 viruses?
One of them was 170.
But is there a sense in, right, so you
it's 175 and this is 63.
No, I'm sorry, but the time-wise, right, so you draw this triangle.
Yes.
Right? So, there's no notion of time in this picture, but I'm just wondering if there is a data from, you know, 1 year earlier where it's not 120 but only 30.
Okay, so this first emergence, the emergence, if we do ancestral inference and we, or recent common ancestor, whatever you want to do, and try to date the time where this subgenotype was first recognized, 2004 for this one, 2003 here, 2003 here. This expansion is simply representing that you get this genotype has been seen over and over and over for 175 viruses between 2004 and 2008. So it's really just representing a number of viruses of that same genotype.
How big would it be if you cut it off at 2007?
Well, that's easy for me to do. I've got it all in an Excel spreadsheet. It's not going to go down. I mean, the sampling rate in the database is increasing with time. So some of what you're going to see, the database is very difficult
to normalize for that. I mean, one knows how how many viruses were sampled when. The question is whether one can sort of see the growth in the frequency of that genotype among the samples that were taken in some particular year.
You would have to normalize very carefully because this a lot of these recent viruses were in Africa, and there were some enormous outbreaks in poultry in Africa, and they just went in there and sequenced it. On the other hand, you have to sort of realize that there's lots of people sequencing in lots of areas of the world, and all I can hope is that there's enough input from many different sources, so on average you have a similar effect in all these places. I think that it was actually right around 2008 to 2009 that the big outbreaks in Africa occurred. But I do know that there's a significant number of viruses in here, but I can actually get you numbers. I think I have the Excel spreadsheet with me. Yeah, Julius.
So your methods, you take these test viruses from time two,
mm-hmm.
and you connect them to reference trees from time one, assuming a parser menu, which is the minimum number of segments we're sorting, right?
So I first of all classify the viruses by exactly the process that you were talking about, and that's based on taking your reference tree, adding the segment from the virus to that reference tree, getting bootstrap support, and finding out what its nearest neighbor is with high bootstrap support in that tree. So that allows me to color the segment of the test virus. So now I have this whole bucket full of test viruses. They've all got their segments colored by putting them by themselves into the reference tree. It's very important that test virus goes by itself into the reference tree, because otherwise it's going to, you know, distort the reference tree. So you've got your reference tree, you take a test virus, you take that segment, put it in the tree, calculate bootstrap support for where it locates in the tree, color that segment of the test virus. You've now got a bucket of test viruses that are all colored. And now you look at those and you say, is there any relationship among them? And that's the maximum parsimony connection between the colored genotypes.
So it's not taking into account the minimum sequences. I'm just thinking biologically, you know, it could be as easy to swap all four sequences to do one.
You could, but what you see is that when you color code all these test viruses, you could almost always, especially with a big data set like the H5s, it was very rare that for any color scheme of test virus, you didn't find another test virus that differed by only one color. Now, we have no proof that that means that they're reassorting one segment at a time, but that's the most obvious explanation. There's another study, and it was funny, I was thinking about it, okay, who did this other study, and I don't remember the first author, but it's like, if you say it was another study with Eddie Holmes, you've got a 50% chance of being right. It turns out Eddie Holmes was on this other study. It was a study of viruses from North America, and they color-coded the segments according to lineages. They didn't actually make a big song and dance about it, but they effectively, they have the same result in there. That they saw lots of reassortance. There was actually really strong evidence for lots of multiple infections, and that's the bottom line of all this. No one really realized that multiple infections could be so prevalent. But if you look at their data, what you see is their color coding differs at one segment from something else that's very similar. So they, using not a rigorous approach at all, actually see something like it.
And theirs is with human or with avian?
Avian. Theirs is with North American avian, mixed serotypes. And actually, the other people that have done a lot of work on genotyping is the group that I sort of associate with Hong Kong University. And they have a different genotyping scheme, and I have the relationship between theirs and ours. But if you look at it, their method is a little coarser, so they don't get single segment differences between all of their genotypes. But if they looked for a maximum parsimony connection using their genotyping, a lot of their viruses would also would differ by just one segment color in their genotypes. It doesn't contradict it. Well, actually, I suppose it does. Yeah, it does. Right, because otherwise you get binomial. Yeah. Right. And in a way, you're right. And yeah, it distinctly contradicts that. Now, what we don't know is everything that occurs in the virus. What we're seeing is something that comes out of the host, and it manages to be fit enough to be able to transmit and grow in, you know, we have two genotypes that differ by one segment, but they may have passed through many birds before they become the other genotype.
So that's the really interesting question. If you did reassortment in the lab, would there be a binomial distribution of which are taken, and then only the ones with one are selected somehow?
Yeah, in fact, if you do reassortment in the lab, you do see that it's very promiscuous. So the fact that there are points, there's places here where you can see it's very promiscuous. It happens to be interestingly at the time when HA was also evolving like gangbusters. But a lot of these didn't persist, most of them didn't. Now, whether that's fitness, whether it's co-circulation in the same geographic area, what you do see is these sub-genotypes, to the extent that you could peer into the data and pinpoint them geographically, they loosely occur in the same geographical region of Southeast Asia. sometimes maybe you see examples of those sub-genotypes at the same time in China, but we don't have closer geographic location than that.
This points to, you alluded to this already in your summary, to the action of selection of these recombinations. I wonder whether one thing that would be addressable within your method is whether there is a long-term constraint on this recombination rate. Mm-hmm. One could imagine that you produce a lot of recombinants on small time and spatial scales, but some of them are only transient successes. Mm-hmm. So you see them for a while in that country and so on, but they don't really make it into the long-term lineage. Mm-hmm. And so I guess if you assume the molecular clock for these recombinations, then you would get a prediction how sort of recombinant diversity increase, say, from a mm-hmm. given year over longer times, mm-hmm. because you have this short-term rate of exchange of segments. And maybe one could see whether the actual course is slower or follows mm-hmm. that model or something, because you do have data over quite a span of
years. Yes. And it's another reason why it's good to work with H5N1. There's good data set. I mean, 650 whole genomes is actually pretty amazing. I should quit because there's someone else speaking after me, and I'm sure everyone wants to get up and have a drink of water. cough, coffee, whatever.